Meeting of the Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Ellison.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grosso. Representative Grosso.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewlett.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero. Representative Lucero. Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill. Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston, excused. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Raleigh. Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Representative Mueller. Representative O'Neill. That completes roll call.
Very well, a quorum is present. Members, the first order of business I need to do our little disclaimer. This meeting is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01, Emergency House Operations in Response to the COVID-19 Infectious Disease Pandemic, requiring a public health exercise of social distancing. Members of the public can view House Rule 10.01 on the Minnesota House website, and you can also visit our committee page on the Minnesota website for instructions on public participation in the proceedings and for viewing and instructions online. Members, we didn't talk about this last time, but we're, well, actually, no, let me just slow down. Some of the members were able to use the hands function to be recognized. I would ask members who wishing to be recognized to use that hand function. I also want to acknowledge a couple things. One, I may not always see it. And two, it may not always work, apparently. If that's the case, please do not hesitate to just simply verbally, you know, call the chair's attention to make sure that you are on a list to be recognized for comments or questions, inquiries by the chair. With that, members, our first order of business is to adopt the minutes from our last meeting. And I'm wondering if our Vice Chair, Representative Frazier, would so move.
Yes, Chair, so move.
Very well. Representative Frazier moves adoption of the minutes from, let me make sure I've got the right date, January 12th.
Yes.
Very well. Discussion. Let me just turn to our minority lead, Representative Johnson. This is a pro forma vote. Are you fine with us just doing a verbal vote on this?
On the minutes, absolutely.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Johnson. So the motion is to adopt the minutes from January 12th. 2021. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and the minutes from January 12th are so adopted. Members, today's agenda should be a rich one, but it's not a terribly complicated one. We will have two overviews, and for some of the members who have been here before. It's absolutely appropriate and not unusual to spend the first days of our committee hearings in receiving basic information about the departments and sometimes about the issues that we regularly interact with and have a responsibility to. Two of those entities are with us here today, the Department of Public Safety, as well as the Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. And so today's meeting will basically encompass an overview from both of those entities with opportunity for discussion. I'm hoping that we can do 20 minutes of presentation followed by 25 minutes of question and answer discussion and then move on from one to the other. So with that, members, I'll ask Commissioner John Harrington to come forward and begin the overview of the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, John Harrington, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. I want to thank you for allowing me to come today to meet with your members. And I also want to express my thanks for the men and women of the Department of Public Safety who, I will tell you, in 2020 have gone above and beyond the call of duty over and over again. From Brian Schwartz, who gave a doctor his mask during the COVID crisis on a traffic stop, to the department, to the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, has been running the State Emergency Operations Center for 305 straight days without a COVID infection. It has literally been an all hands on deck year for us in 2020. Next slide.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you. So, the mission of the Department of Public Safety is to serve all communities to build a safer Minnesota. And the word safety is built into the very fabric of us. But one of the things that I learned upon coming into this office is that safety has 11 different divisions and has 2,000 different people that are working on it. And it takes a myriad of forms and functions to be able to talk about safety in the state of Minnesota. DPS has been challenged quite literally to be in more places than I can ever recall, from the BCA responding and investigating officer-involved shootings. I mentioned to recently that it was this time last year, I think it was on January 6th, that Officer Mattson from Waseca was shot and injured, and we're very, very blessed that he is recovering from his injuries and is well on the way to you know, back to normal, and that the person who assaulted him is been held accountable and is already serving his time at that point. But we ended the year on pretty much on the same note. On December 20th, we were involved in investigating an officer-involved shooting in the city of Minneapolis. And that really does sort of bracket how the Department of Public Safety has seen the year. We've been in greater Minnesota, we've been in the Twin Cities, and we've been everywhere in between all throughout this year. Just to think about a few things, we are the agency that was responsible for in doing the investigation, the criminal investigation on George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis. The state fire marshal has had to respond to 53 fatal fires. That doesn't count the huge commercial fires that they've also responded to. BCA has seen 53% uptick in murders that they have been responding to. And we have seen an increase in domestic violence through our Office of Justice programming as women and victims have been more and more isolated, in no small part because of COVID. But we have seen greater isolation of women and domestic violence victims from family and friends and from their advocates who have worked so well to keep them safe. Next slide, Kitty. I mentioned that we're a pretty complicated body to understand, that we're in two different committees. So the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee has one area and your committee has the other area. And quite frankly, it's not as clean as that line that separates them because, for example, Capital Security, which fits under Minnesota State Patrol in the transportation side, quite honestly, is very much a public safety issue. And I know in these days after December 6th, in the light of what happened at the United States Capitol, that many of your members and many of your constituents are incredibly concerned about the security and the safety at the Capitol and of their elected officials. And so it's not a bright line that says, well, the state patrol is on one side, and while that is where the funding goes through and maybe jurisdiction goes through, we recognize that in many cases we have duties that fit in both sides, and we try and make them work. In addition to that, one of the things that I'm very proud of with DPS is it's sort of a different approach to it, is that we've been really much more community-based and community-focused. I hired Nicole Archbold as the Director of Community Outreach and Community Affairs, and she has convened and connected us to churches, literally the churches, the synagogues, and the mosques all over the state of Minnesota. We have been talking to them from hosting one of the first grand, like 200-person meetings to talk about shootings at religious places of worship, and trying to give them some tools so that they could reduce extreme violence in their midst, to working with parks to talk about youth violence and how we can reduce bullying and things along that lines, working with schools on school safety and issues around what happens when there's an active shooter or what happens when someone is mentally ill in one of our schools. Public housing, we've met with them, and shelters, both domestic violence and homeless shelters, have all been part of the outreach work that we've done. She did all of that on top of being the lead person out of my staff working on the Reducing Deadly Force Encounters Working Group, whose report is in its final stages of completion right now. On the public safety side, we have Alcohol Gambling Enforcement, Fire Marshals Division, the Office of Justice Programming, ECN, which is the 911 system, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and the BCA. And I'm going to go through each of those individually as we go along. Next slide. The history of the Department of Public Safety, I tell this story because Randy Kelly, who was both the mayor that hired me as chief of police and my senator as living on the east side, once told me the story that the Department of Public Safety was created when all the other departments had been finished and had been given their missions, and whatever was left got put into us. And if you look at that sort of a hodgepodge of the fire marshals there and victim services there and driver's license services there, there's a certain sagacity to how I think he says we were created. We're an old division, though. The state fire marshal is one of the first agencies with 1905 being created. The BCA was created in 1927. The department actually didn't get created until 1969. But we've been one of the first departments where we have DNA laboratories that are routinely, and fast DNA and innovations in technology is something the department is very, very much engaged with. Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement was created in 96. Office of Justice Programs were created in 2003, and the Department of Homeland Security, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in 2004. Next slide, please. Carla Sincotta is the director for the Alcohol Gambling Enforcement Division. Their mission is to work in the areas, right in their name, bars, restaurants that serve liquor, casinos, and gambling. Those are that's the bread and butter of what AGE does. They are responsible for both regulating and taking enforcement action when bars, restaurants, or gambling establishments are seen to be in violation of state liquor laws, whether they're in violation of state gambling laws. And they also make sure that the casinos all over the state of Minnesota, that the slot machines and all the other gambling devices are playing by a fair set of rules that, while I have never seen a casino that isn't making money, at least you need to at least have a fair chance of winning when you're gambling there. Next slide. I mentioned the alcohol side of the things. They do more than simply regulate it, though. So they do provide education about alcohol, including, for example, what should bouncers and bartenders look for so that they're not over-serving and not creating an environment where people are leaving the in tavern or restaurant or bar impaired. They do issue and approve the liquor licenses and permits. They conduct pre-license and compliance inspections, and then they also do investigations. And that has been one of the things that has kept us really busy this year, as with the EO, there were regulations imposed on licensed liquor establishments. Some of them were closed by their own city ordinances. Some were, in fact, closed due to governor's orders. And the alcohol gambling group has in fact gone out and done the investigations when we've had complaints. And we have had literally hundreds and hundreds of complaints from the public about bars being open in violation of their licenses and or in violation of the EOs. Next slide, please. On the gambling side of the house, one of the things that has been it's taken up more time than we thought it would have this year, has been investigating theft of lottery tickets. During the riots during George Floyd, many gas stations and restaurants and pharmacies that sold lottery tickets were broken into. They were burned and they were looted. And among the things that were stolen were lottery tickets. And when those lottery tickets pop up, as they continue to do, AGE is in charge of going out and investigating who had that lottery ticket that was stolen and trying to make sure that we both recover the proceeds and hold them accountable to the extent we can for possession of essentially stolen property. Their normal routine, though, is to provide education around the gambling laws, verify compliance with the state and tribal compacts around the casinos, and investigate any issues around lawful gambling, for example, pull tabs, bingo, things along that lines, and then also allegations of bookmaking and other illegal gambling. They also do the background investigations for those folks that want to get into the gambling business in one fashion or another. Next. Recent achievements for them was implementing an updated online liquor license application. In this age of COVID, if you can't find a way to get your job done online, it is very, very difficult to get your job done at all. They also implemented a responsible beverage service training. So next slide. James Smith is the state fire marshal. And the state fire marshal, as I mentioned, is one of the oldest of the agencies in the department. They protect lives and property through working with local fire departments to prevent, educate, regulate, and then oftentimes collect the data and do emergency response themselves. Next slide. I mentioned that we've had 53 fatal fires. Most of them, or a lot of them, I'd say, were smoking related. And so that continues to be a challenge. It's one that we wanted to take on this year, is to try and how do we educate people? Are there education or enforcement or engineering ways that we can reduce the number of Minnesotans that die in terrible, terrible fires? We've also seen them investigating several major construction fires, St. Cloud, I believe Marshall, and then one just around the corner from here, across the street from the X. One of the things that, once again, an unusual year for them, we tasked them with coordinating with the Federal Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Department, the St. Paul Fire Department's arson investigation, and the Minneapolis Fire Department's arson investigation to do the investigations on the arson fires that happened during the spring and summer riots. And as a result of their work coordinating that, literally hundreds of items of incendiaries were collected. And as the last count, I believe, from the FBI, 13 people have been federally indicted based on the investigations that the state fire marshal helped lead. Next slide. As I mentioned, both it was not Marshall, it was Grand Rapids and St. Cloud. And that, once again, those resulted in felony arson charges. They managed a very successful COVID-related project where they asked fire departments to be the receiving place for making homemade masks. And it generated 100,000 homemade masks that we then distributed to congregate living facilities across the state of Minnesota. Next slide, please. Kate Weeks runs the Office of Justice Programming. They are our victim-centric operation. They take care of crime victims, but they also take care of the agencies and the advocacy groups that take care of victims. One of the things that I asked them to do this last year that they've done an amazing job of was to initiate a statewide domestic violence resource approach. They did trainings with police departments, with shelters, and because of that, we kept the lines of communication open from the domestic violence advocates groups to the police departments and to criminal justice agencies. And we came up with some really novel insights about what was happening in houses, oftentimes isolated by COVID, that weren't necessarily being seen by the public, but we know there was victimization going on there. Next slide. The list of their duties is too long for me to go through, but I'll just highlight crime victim reparations, which reimburses victims of violent crime when they have had out-of-pocket costs or whether they need counseling or medical costs there. The Crime Victim Justice Unit, which is the new name for the ombudsman, where they look at issues around whether or not the criminal justice system is functioning properly. And then what probably most people know them about is their grants management unit, where we provide grants to for child abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, general crime, and a wide variety of other needed services. Next slide. Two big projects that they took on this year. The one number one that's on the slide is highlighted is they were the primary staff people that supported the work of the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Task Force, which released its report in December. But they also were the primary staff people supporting the Criminal Sexual Conduct Task Force. They managed to do really some what I think is almost magical work of we were enabled to give out $8 million in CRF funds. But we had a very short timeline, and they managed to recruit, assess, and grant $8 million to community-based agencies all over the state of Minnesota. It really was, given the slowness of state government and the difficulty of doing this remotely, it was really looked magical to see them be able to pull this together. There were a lot of folks that told us we couldn't do this, but we have done it and done it well. Next slide, please. Dana Wahlberg runs the ECN network. And ECN, the easy way to think about that is it's the 911 system. Whenever you call 911, your call is being routed through one of Dana's networks. We had the outage the last couple of days ago in southern Minnesota. We had Dana and her staff working with the national providers to make sure that the fiber cut was taken care of. In addition to the 911 system, though, they are also the backbone for every time a squad car gets dispatched and someone will answer, every time an ambulance is dispatched, every time a fire engine is dispatched, the armor network that allows interoperable communications both on a day-to-day basis and in a crisis is absolutely something that ECN is responsible for. Next slide. As you can see, you go from the 911 call, it goes through a routing system and then actually gets sent to the right place. So no matter where you are, when your cell phone gets pinged, it checks with the tower, it decides where it needs to go, and it decides automatically, just faster than you could have dialed it, where that call should be going so that we can get the right first responder to you as fast as possible. Next slide. I mentioned the armor system. We also have the integrated public alert and warning system, or IPAWS. Oftentimes, when you get those emergency alerts, that is coming through that. And then FirstNet is our backup system. When the system crashes, this is what allows first responders to continue to communicate. Next slide. Recent accomplishments, including moving to an IP-based statewide next generation 9/11 platform. I think that was one of the most important technological pieces because it means that we will have redundancy and we will not see system failure or system crashes, which we see rarely to begin with, but I think it is important that we're continuing to do that. And it also allows us to do the text to 911 system. Next slide. General Joe Kelly runs the Homeland Security and Emergency Management Division. They are the division that prepares for, responds to, and recovers from emergencies and disasters. They have been incredibly busy because they have been partnered with MDH, the Department of Health, as being the primary admin and logistics group to make sure that all of the COVID relief efforts have gone forward. Next slide. And so whether it is training emergency managers so that they know what to do in a crisis, responding when we do have a crisis, or then assisting those emergency managers in trying to figure out how do we recover from a windstorm or a flood or a natural or a man-made disaster, they are integrated into the emergency management departments in all 87 counties. Next slide. I mentioned their record of 305 days without an infection. Whether it has been testing, tracing, providing PPE, medical emergencies, and now working on vaccinations, HSEM has been there at the table making sure that things got done. In addition to that, they also run our school safety center, and they are also been working with tribal nations and others on nuclear plants and how do we have emergency plans ready for that. Next slide, please. The VCA, which is run by Superintendent Drew Evans, they are your state crime investigative agency, and that's what they're primarily known for. But in addition to that, they're also your state crime lab, and they're also your state criminal justice information conduit. Every piece of information from the local police department that has to hit the state system and every piece of information that they want to access from the federal government has to go through the pipeline at the BCA. And so the BCA has a system that has a no-fail option. We cannot have an officer out on the side of the road checking for warrants and either getting bad information or getting no information. At the same time, we also, when we have to communicate with our federal partners, as we did on the 6th to check on whether or not state capitals were being overrun and breached, the BCA is also our conduit for that piece of information. It's been a tough year crime-wise. I think everyone, especially those in the metro area, have seen the record number of homicides from Minneapolis and St. Paul, but that number wasn't just in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Our preliminary data, and it is preliminary data, we won't have good firm counts for at least another month or so, but our preliminary data shows 187 murders were committed in the state of Minnesota. Almost 4,000 robberies, the carjackings that I've mentioned before often were part of that, and then 8,000 aggravated assaults, and many of those were domestic violence cases. Next slide, please. They're headquartered in St. Paul, but they have field offices all over the state of Minnesota, with Bemidji being a major one, with labs both in Bemidji and in St. Cloud. Next slide. Their investigative sections include predatory crimes, financial crimes, Human Trafficking Task Force, and the Fusion Center. Predatory crimes, sex offender registration and tracking of those folks, financial crimes. During COVID, we saw a real uptick in frauds committed against seniors, where those were in fact scams that the Financial Crimes Task Force worked on. Human Trafficking Task Force is working currently both, hear about them a lot when we're having major events, but we are integrated into the Line 3 task force to make sure that there are no man camps up there where human trafficking is going on. And the Fusion Center is, every state has a Fusion Center, which is the information pooling place for the state. So when we were looking at reports of breaches in in other capitals, the Fusion Center was our conduit there. When I checked to see what's going on about a crime committed in another state, the Fusion Center is our conduit for that information. Next slide, please. I mentioned that they're your state crime lab, DNA, chemistry, and we've seen a lot of increases in, for example, some new regulations that have required us to do more testing on marijuana. We've seen more cases where we've been asked to do many more firearms checks and more ballistics checks because of the frequency of gun violence. But they're also your digital multimedia check. And so if you think about any officer involved shooting where there are body cams, all of those body cams have to be downloaded and processed in a way that they are best evidence, kept safe for prosecution, but it is a task because there are a variety of different systems there. Next slide. I mentioned the Justice Information Center and over 50 computer applications that provide data. It is an incredibly labor intensive, and it is an area that we are regulated heavily because we are having access to federal and other state data. And so we have to be extremely protective about making sure that it is a system that does not have cyber breaches or cyber intrusions into it, that we have to keep that data safe. Next slide. Recent achievements, among them, we have now a forensic dog. This canine sniffs out computer equipment and hard drives. Now, you might think, well, why do you want an electronic canine? One of the duties of the BCA is working on child pornography cases. And so when we're going in to do a search warrant in a house where there's allegation of child pornography, where can you hide a flash drive? Where can you hide digital evidence? And so this dog has already paid dividends many, many times over. It sniffs out electronic media, and it has allowed us to find caches of child pornography and hold child pornographers and those who traffic in that accountable. They have already begun implementing the Deadly Forest Working Group recommendations, including hiring the community service program and hiring our victim family representative, B2. And they are transitioning our state from UCR, which is the old FBI standard, into NIBRS, which is the new standard that every department will have to be integrated in. And it's really, we're ahead of schedule on finishing up that FBI deadline for the project. I think that is the end of my slides, and I stand ready for any questions.
Commissioner, well done. Very thorough, and boy, right on time in terms of the...
Trying to keep it on time.
We have had a couple of members that have joined us. I just want to make sure, I think Representative O'Neill, you joined, so we'll register you on the roll. I don't know if anyone else has joined us, so I missed the roll. If you did, let me know. Commissioner, let me start by asking a question. Obviously, in this past year, even half a year, the department has been involved in a number of high-profile events, and the expectation to provide a safety for high-profile events, perhaps over the course of the next week or so. Those events, involve different jurisdictions. So I wonder if you can just tell us quickly, what is the process by which those jurisdictions would access the DPS? What's the role that DPS plays in terms of local public safety units working across jurisdictions to provide safety for high-profile events? And what can you tell us quickly? We'll probably visit this again later, and that's partly why I'm asking the question now, so no need to get super detailed, but how have we typically handled the excess costs that these kind of events, would incur?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll answer that in brief, and then perhaps Drew Evans may want to chime in here. We run the Fusion Center, which is federally supported. And the Fusion Center, to give you a sort of a visual of it, it's a hub and spokes. And so we're the hub, and we're the pooling place for information to come in. And then once the information comes in, we manage the information and then push it back out to where it needs to be. So a tip that comes in, I'll give you an example. We had a tip on a school safety tip. It was about a school shooter, and they were from a specific city. The hub takes that information. We check all of the schools to see if we have a school that matches that. We then reach out to that jurisdiction to say, we have a tip about this young man in your school. Do you have that? Is that in fact accurate? That police department then goes, checks the schools, finds out that the young man did go to school there. He has now moved to Florida. We then, as the hub, transmit that information to the Florida Fusion Center so that they can then take the appropriate action about the internet threat that he had made about doing a school shooting. Superintendent Evans, do you want to fill in where I left off?
Well, and let me just stop right there just for a second. That's really actually very helpful. And I didn't know much or anything about the Fusion Center until the last panel, but very specifically, what I'm inquiring about, I should have been more specific, is the civic unrest events that we had over the course of the spring, the preparedness that's currently being planned for leading up to the national inauguration, those involved cross jurisdictional coordination, I would imagine, as well as costs that locals would pick up. And so that's really the nature of my question in terms of how does that process work? Who does St. Paul call? Do they call you? How do they connect with, and coordinate with other, public safety units? And again, I'm imagining that there is excess cost that these kind of events, you know, could trigger for all sorts of local public safety units.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't really speak to the cost because I don't really believe that we don't bill the local agencies because the Fusion Center, once again, is federally subsidized, heavily subsidized that way. But what I can tell you is, for example, we are members of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force. So we have a BCA officer who's on the task force. Because he's on the task force, he has access to all of the FBI data that would be involved in a plot to attack the Capitol or to attack a member of Congress or a member of the legislature or other criminal activity that's terrorism related. We are on a number of those kinds of task forces so that we are in a position to share information with each other. And there is typically not a cost factor. Now, I will tell you, we have incurred a significant amount of overtime during 2020 because during the May spring riots or May summer riots, we were operating 24/7 and that our funding is really only for a 14 to 16 hour a day operation. And so we incurred overtime there. But overtime is not something that's unusual for the BCA to incur because we have no idea on any given year, how many murders will there be? How many significant criminal sexual conduct cases will it be? And once you have one of those, and once you're into the investigation, you just have to run that down until you solve the case or it runs out of evidence that you can follow up on. And that may mean that you're working, you know, a multiple fatality murder. You may be working that for days or weeks at a time, and you're going to incur some overtime there. The BCA simply has a budget that adopts and can absorb that overtime. And we recognize that that is just a cost of doing business as an investigative agency, much like the State Patrol has to absorb that cost when there's a bad blizzard and they have every trooper out on the road trying to rescue people from up from the snow.
Director Evans.
Yeah, I would just reiterate, I'm sorry, I'm getting used to being online again, Chair. So Chair Mariani and members of the committee.
Welcome to the new norm.
Yeah. Thank you, yeah. I am the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. I'm glad to be in front of you, especially to meet some of the new members. I look forward to working with all of you. As the commissioner said into your question, Chair Mariani, no services that the BCA, for example, provides to communities across Minnesota, no communities are charged for those. That's within our base budget that all of you provide every year. And as the commissioner said, you know, we're used to working in a dynamic world in the public safety realm. And so we're regularly adjusting budgets and dealing with contingencies as they come up. To your question about if there's civil unrest or other items like that, all of us are actively engaged with our law enforcement partners. So they may be calling us for various levels of assistance, whether it be the BCA, State Patrol, State Fire Marshal's Office, and we provide those services free of charge to those agencies across Minnesota. We're in unusual times right now, and we're experiencing more demand on services than we've ever had before. So typically the way that it works is that we provide those services, and if the state agency gets into a position where there is a deficiency, we would come to you with that deficiency request. But that being said, we are actively managing budgets all the time and preparing for, you know, significant amounts of overtime or cost expenses, and we manage those as best we can year in, year out. And I will say that almost always we're able to do that within the budgets you provide us.
Very well, thank you. To be continued when we have conversations around the budget for the department.
And Mr. Chair, the only other thing I would add in answer to your question is we have a 24/7 duty officer, which is a phone line and an email system that is always staffed through the BCA. And that is how, in most cases, local law enforcement and or federal law enforcement would call to either give us information about something or to make an inquiry about there had been a major fire or there had been a death or there had been a murder. That is oftentimes the way that we will get the information if it's not strictly investigations, in which case they may call the closest field office or regional field office for assistance in that case.
Very well. Chair Pinto, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Commissioner, to you and to your whole team for your hard work. I know this past year has been a really challenging one. I know that right now in particular, a lot of concerns about safety, and just really appreciate your work. I think my question is maybe directed a little more to Superintendent Evans, and really appreciate his work as well. We had passed last year, so this is a shift, legislation to make the state responsible for storage and tracking of sexual assault kits. And I just want to find out, so this is a new function, if you could just kind of share how that is working out and give us some just some background details on that.
Commissioner Evans.
Chair Mariani and members, thank you for the question, Representative Pinto. It's a really good one. And for any members that may not be familiar, there was legislation that was passed that takes care of a few things. One, a uniform consent form to release both restricted and unrestricted sexual assault examination kits. Two, to store all restricted kits, meaning kits that have not been released or cleared for testing in a laboratory centrally at the BCA, and then to implement a tracking system for the BCA in addition to testing all kits in Minnesota. In other words, there is no discretion anymore. Once it's been cleared and it is an unrestricted kit, it will be tested by a crime laboratory. The uniform consent form went online. We are actively engaging in a number of pieces surrounding the storage of the restricted kits. We've started receiving those kits into the BCA. We're working with both advocacy and SAME programs on an ongoing basis to work out the flow of those kits and to make sure we're addressing any issues that may pop up, because it's a new program, but those kits are coming in, the consent form is online, and we're in the RFP process currently for the tracking system. Because of the expense, it'll need to go through the state procurement process, but we'll be working with groups there to modify that in a way to make sure that we're covering everything we need to in Minnesota. And this year's going fast, quickly. Last update I had, we'd have that on 6 to 9 months where we felt we'd be operational with the tracking program. So we're looking at summer or fall for that, because it interacts with a whole bunch of different components of the system, from our victim survivors to our SANE programs, to the BCA, to our prosecutors, to our law enforcement collectively. So there's a lot of pieces with the tracking program, but we are actively storing the restricted kits now for law enforcement across Minnesota and our hospital systems.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Superintendent.
Thank you, Superintendent. We're kind of running out of time. I'm going to jump over to Minority Lead Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Superintendent Evans, Commissioner Harrington, I want to thank you for being here. I just have a couple comments. One, I know of the huge increase in homicide, especially in Minneapolis this past year, has really put a lot of stress on the BCA and their agents. And I want to thank Superintendent Evans for his staff. I've worked with many of them. I've worked with him as well on some things back when I was in law enforcement. And BCA agents are probably some of our best investigators that we have in this state. I know they have a bad habit of stealing the good ones from the sheriff's offices as well. And Commissioner Heron, I want to thank you for your statement as well, calling what was happening last spring or last this summer, actually what they were, as riots and not peaceful protests. So I want to thank you for that.
I'm going to squeeze one more question here, Representative Vang.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps this question can be for Superintendent Evans. So as an advocate for CBD legalization, I understand that CBD legalization has had an impact on testing. So what impact has it had? Does this testing affect the testing of sexual assault kits? Also, if marijuana was legal in a way that led to less prosecution, would that allow for a quicker testing on harder drugs and sexual assault kits?
Director Evans.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Vang. It's an excellent question. CBD legalization and other derivatives of cannabis has created an impact on our laboratory in this way. There was a change in the definition of marijuana that was associated with that, and it has to do with the legalization of a certain percentage of THC that still exists in these products. What that has done is it has required us to change our testing process so that we identify and quantify the amount of THC in any product that we're examining so that we can identify it and show it is over that legal threshold. That process has been validated within the BCA now. We have done that because we need to do it because we had predicted with this that the defense bar would challenge our identification of marijuana under our current testing processes. When that occurred, there was recently even a consolidated case across Minnesota consolidating all the cases to try and not allow testimony from our scientists on the identification of marijuana. We have just brought that process online. What the impact is that it creates a process that is 3 to 5 times longer than our traditional marijuana analysis. It does not impact our analysis of sexual assault examination kits, simply because it's a different laboratory. And so our laboratories within the BCA, that is our drug chemistry laboratory, which are specialty scientists for that. And then our DNA laboratories, our biology laboratory, they focus on that. I will tell you, even with our marijuana examinations and bringing this new technology online to quantify the amount, is that we only do it in cases where a court date has been set in the cases, and then we will quantify that for felony level amounts of marijuana. And then that is up to the prosecutor to determine whether or not it is the best use of the resources moving forward to prosecute that particular case. But that I should note, even with potential legalization, it will be necessary to have the ability to do that in any regulatory framework that I've seen if there was illicit or black market trafficking of to avoid taxes, whatever it may be, under any regulatory framework I've seen in other states. So we would need to maintain the capability.
Very well. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Evans. Representative Lucero, I am going to squeeze you in, you'll be the last one here.
I appreciate it, because I was going to say I had my hand. I was actually the first one to raise my hand, so I appreciate you indulging me. And my question actually is for Commissioner Harrington. A comment and then a question. So I recently learned that my wife and I were watching some Hotel Impossible show or something, and there's dogs that can sniff out bed bugs. But this is the first I've heard of dogs that are able to sniff out digital media, so that's really, really cool. To my question, so over the last 6-9 months, I've attended multiple rallies at the Capitol, and in many of these rallies, not all of them, but many of them, there was a good show of presence at the Capitol by law enforcement. And Commissioner Harrington, I want to thank you for the phone call we actually had. Was it early this week, late last week?
Late last week.
At 9 p.m., the commissioner was still working. So we had a great exchange. And in that conversation, I just thank the commissioner. Thank you, Commissioner Harrington, and all the professional men and women that are working so hard to keep each and every one of us safe. And so in these gatherings, rallies that I've attended over these months, a good show of presence. And every time I'm there and there is a good show of presence, I make a point to thank them for the sacrifices that they're making to risking their lives to protect ours. So again, very, very good. And I know we're in challenging times right now, so I appreciate your leadership on that. So my question is, as I examine, and I'm asking actually this as a pass-through question, because people have been reaching out to me, constituents and others, asking, Eric, the show of presence of the law enforcement that are protecting our capital is excellent, but Eric, what's the reason why in less than 2 weeks, so just days after the violent riots in Minneapolis, there was an attack on our Capitol with the Christopher Columbus statue? Why, even though there was advance notice, why weren't there actions taken to prevent the vandalism and the attack on our Capitol? And I don't have an answer for them, so I'm just wondering if you could help give some insight on how I can answer them, I guess.
Yeah, Director, very quickly, because we are behind now, I want to catch up with the next testifiers, and you can certainly do some follow-up offline as well with this, but please, Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative...
Oh, Lucero. Commissioner, I'm sorry.
I will try and keep this very brief. We regularly staff the Capitol at a level for the threats that we know that are coming. And then there are occasions where the information we have is not sufficient to raise enough of an alarm that you have additional resources there. And I'm happy we've actually had several conversations with other of your colleagues about the response the State Patrol had to the Columbus statue event. And I'm also happy to talk about kind of how we manage both the information and our response based on whether it is a property crime, simply a rally, because literally we have rallies at the Capitol on a daily basis. And so in most of those cases, it is simply just a gathering where people are going to exercise their First Amendment rights and no damage is noted. But in those cases where we really do believe that there is going to be damage, we do take it very, very seriously. And as things have escalated over this year, we have had to modify our tactics and our approaches to make sure that that we can respond appropriately and not over-respond. We take our commitment to the First Amendment very, very seriously, but we also take our commitment to protect the Capitol and those that are in the Capitol equally seriously.
Commissioner and Director, thank you for being with us here today and providing a very concise overview of a very important and to some degree complex and broad waterfront, if you will, of very important work. I look forward to our working together throughout the course of this session. You will be back and we'll be able to go into more details on a number of all of these areas. With that, members, we're going to move forward with the overview of the Peace Officers Standard and Training Board.
Mr. Chair,
Chair Kelly McCarthy, who is board chair of the Pulse Board, as well as the executive director, Eric Missel. I did hear a voice. Is that you, Representative Grasso?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick correction on a comment that the commissioner made.
Representative Grasso, we're not going to do that. We're going to use the hand function to get on. I will try to call on everyone within the time limits that the chair has set. I explained at the very beginning of this hearing that if we do not adhere to our ability to meet our schedule, it's going to be way more difficult nowadays in this virtual platform to bring people back into evening discussions. And so what I'm asking for, what I will be asserting, is that we hew as closely as possible with some flexibility. I exercised a little bit of that when I went over the time in order to get Representative Lucero's question in and Representative Vang's. And so with your understanding, what I want to do is move forward. I'm sure there's going to be plenty of time, during the course of this session for you to bring up other issues or related issues as well. I will work hard to make sure that if you're seeking to be called on, that I will call on you and do that within the ability of us to be effective in terms of meeting our schedule. So with that, members, I'm going to ask Chief McCarthy and Mr. Missel to come forward. And I'm guessing the chief is going first as the board chair, but it's just a guess.
It is just a guess. Thank you, chair, members of the committee. I am just here to say hello, and my participation will be mostly if there are any questions. But Executive Director Misselt is here, and he will take you through the overview.
Very well. Welcome, chief, and welcome to you, Executive Director Misselt.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you to all the members, the new members, as well as the existing members from last session. I look forward to working with all of you, and I will keep this as brief as I possibly can. Just a brief overview and then a little bit of an update. So for those who don't know, the Post Board is a licensing and regulatory agency. We oversee peace officers in the state of Minnesota. We are Minnesota is a little bit unique in being a licensing state. Many states are certification states. We're not the only one, but we've been at it for a long time. It was created by legislation in 1977, Our main enabling statutes are 626.84. That's the enabling legislation and covers the makeup of the board, what we do, what our mission is. And then equally as important is our governing rules, Chapter 67, administrative rules. And I'll talk a little bit about what we're doing with those going forward. Of course, they act as really the same force of legislation in a lot of ways in how we do our business every day. Our role, as I mentioned, is a licensing and regulatory agency. We are part of the executive branch, an independent regulatory board. Members are appointed by the governor. We currently have 17 members. It was 15, and then with the reform legislation passed during the special session, that went to 17. I'll talk about the composition of that in a little bit. The main areas that we oversee are your pre-service education, meaning the folks that come right out of college or whatnot that want to be a police officer. They have to have post-secondary education, and in the case of the state of Minnesota, a minimum of a two-year college degree. Then they would go through what is currently called skills or the professional peace officer education program to basically teach the nuts and bolts of being an officer. The other big piece we do is testing. We have an online test. It's computer-based, has been computer-based since I think we went live in 18, and it works very well. It allows candidates who would like to become police officers in the state of Minnesota to test really all over the country, even worldwide. I believe last year, a year before, we had an individual who had applied for reciprocity and tested overseas in Iraq or somewhere in the Middle East, was able to take the exam there. So kind of on the front forefront of that. Licensing is the other big issue. Once the education's done, they pass the exam, and the department hires a candidate, then they become officially licensed. Prior to that, they're only license eligible. You do not get your license issued to you until you're actually hired by a police department or a sheriff's department or the state agency. Once you're licensed and the officer's out there working, there's a requirement of continuing education, like most professions, same with nursing or law, you know, lawyers or et cetera. That requirement is 48 hours over a three-year licensing cycle. So that licensing cycle runs for 3 years. So roughly every year when we go through renewal, the post board is processing anywhere from 3,300 to 4,000 renewals annually to get to the total of 11 to 12,000 peace officers we have in the state. Now that includes active and inactive. And then the final big piece, and this was a piece of a part of our role that has obviously been looked at or received a lot of scrutiny last year or so, is violations of standards of conduct and violations of their licensure. And what is the post board's role in that regard? How far do we go? And that is all being looked at and examined. And quite honestly, just overall, across all these business processes, we are in a stage of updating, review, you name it, shifting our paradigms. And again, I may speak to that a little bit earlier. There may be or a little bit later. There should be questions. I'm guessing to that effect. So, what are our stakeholders? The post board answers to a myriad of stakeholders across the state: peace officers, citizens. We receive complaints directly from citizens, from cities. We take complaints from anyone and everybody that chooses to file a complaint or has a question. We also work closely or are involved in a stakeholder relationship with the MPPOA, the Minnesota Chiefs, the sheriffs, associations, certainly the courts at times, especially the Office of Administrative Hearings for rulemaking and also disciplinary processes, other state agencies, the League of Minnesota Cities, right up to the governor's office, of course, the legislature, as well as the media. During the let's just say the that was, which was 2020, I spent more time talking to the media during that time than I did the first 2 years. I was here at the Post Board, so obviously a strong stakeholder group. So some of our key strategies at the board, some of the basic functions, our business that we engage in is, of course, creating and administering the licensing exams online. Those are reviewed annually. We have a contract with the PSI, which is the company that develops the exam, brings in subject matter experts, updates it, and so on. And it's administered through Pearson View, which is a company that provides the online portion of the testing. We monitor agency compliance with mandated policies and procedures. We like it. It is annual in the sense that they have to respond to us every year. In fact, we're just starting that now to basically provide testimony, if you will. I'm trying to think of the correct word, but that provide proof that they've adopted all the mandatory policies, and then they submit allegations of misconduct to us as well. We were doing site visits annually to departments. That has been thrown to the wind, obviously, with COVID. We've gone to more calling and touching base and emailing with agencies. We are in the process of reviewing that whole business process as well to see how we'll do that in the future. I would like to see if we're able to get our database up and running and doing the things that we believe it will do, that we'll be able to do a lot of this through online or electronic means versus sending people out. That being said, I don't get down in the weeds at this point, but there is importance to having face-to-face relationship as well. So we're balancing those needs right now. We monitor compliance with standards of conduct. Licensees have to report it to us. We learn of potential violations of standard conduct in a myriad of ways, sometimes from the chief law enforcement officer, the CLEO, as we call them. The licensee themselves is required to report. And it's not perfect by any stretch, you know, we'll just see the article in the paper, just like you all do, and we pinpoint that this is one we've got to watch and keep an eye on, decide if we're going to work on it right now, if we're just going to kind of watch it as it proceeds through the criminal justice system, if in fact it involves criminal charges. And then one of the other big jobs that we do or part of our role is managing the training reimbursement fund. The legislature provides for training for agencies and for officers across the state. It's a sizable amount. We monitor and manage that, make sure that all the officers renewing in that particular year have their 48 credits before they can renew. And part of that is the submission they have to submit for training reimbursement for the costs of doing that training, that continuing education. And then we distribute those funds accordingly. Summary of agency statistics, easy for me to say. I just did this yesterday, actually. So as of right now, January 2021, we have 413 law enforcement agencies. As you can see on the sheet, 303 municipal PDs, 87 sheriff's offices. That hasn't changed and doesn't change typically, obviously. And then we have tribal PDs, the non-municipal specialty PDs. That would be your Metro Transit, Airports Commission, and so on. And then, of course, the state agencies such as the BCA and the State Patrol. The one thing I will say about this statistic, which I don't think is well known and is interesting to me, is that when I started here in October 2017, I believe we were at 432 law enforcement agencies across the state. We are now 3 years, you know, roughly 3 years later, down at 413. Trend I have noticed, against anecdotal, I don't have any, can't give you statistical significance or multiple regression analysis of it, and there's not enough numbers to do that anyway. But it is interesting to see there are a lot of smaller agencies that are dropping off the radar screen. I think that is primarily due to, obviously, budget considerations and so on. And that's at the municipal level. So post-staffing. So post-staffing, we're currently 12 full-time employees, although we only have 10 in the office. We have a couple of vacancies we're still trying to fill. And then there were two more positions that were added during the special session, the 2020 legislature, that were added to address some of the requirements in the police reform bill. And I guess I would just say commentary on that, just to say that Chair Mariani and this group, particularly the members at the time, that was very critical and much appreciated. Many times, I shouldn't say many times, but there are times when agencies are asked to do certain things, but then not provided the resources. And I know I'm very appreciative that we were provided those resources so that we can get this done. Post board members, appointed by the governor to 4-year staggered terms. I will not read to you all of the list there. I think many of you are probably aware of it anyway. The change that I'd mentioned earlier from 15 to 17 comes from the addition of two public members. And I believe that was an effort on part of the Chair Mariani and this committee in the reform legislation. Those positions are yet to be appointed. We're waiting for the appointment of several positions from the governor, governor's office. So right now we are we're a little bit short on the board end, but we have our quorum. We're able to get business done. So I'll just close very quickly by just covering an overview of a couple board initiatives that we are undertaking right now. Early in 2020, shortly after I took over as the interim, we had decided we were going to look at a comprehensive overview of our rules, long overdue, and then under Chapter 67. So there are plenty of rules in there that are either outdated, obsolete, although in a nod to the previous administration, we did clean out a lot of those with a more shortened rulemaking effort that got rid of some of the obsolete rules, but there's still a lot of things that needed to be updated. And then also in light of the reform legislation and what we all view, and I think the chair and I are and the board are all in unison on this, the changing expectations for the post board. There are things in rule that have to be changed to accommodate that and the change environment and where we want to go with this agency. So we did an audit of the post business processes. It's across the board, all the things I mentioned, the pre-service, continuing education, testing, so on and so forth, done by the International Association of Directors of Law Enforcement Standards and Training, or IEDLIS. That goes completed on time in September, October of 2020. And then we're working on reviewing the recommendations and next steps for that. In fact, one of them I'll talk about shortly. And then, of course, the reform legislation that was passed, the big changes that were made or requirements, I would say, for us to meet for the board was the building of a complaint database and officer profile that would allow agencies to report in real-time complaint data, and then also a training database. We need to be able to identify the trainers develop a list of approved trainers that then agencies can send their officers to for particularly the mandated training. It dovetails well in that something that I have thought about for some time is that we need to build a little bit more robust training cadre anyway. So this is going to, I think, work well together. With regard to the database and that computer work, we have signed a contract with a company. They're called Benchmark Analytics out of Chicago, Illinois. They've been around for a little over 10 years. They start out with a partnership with the University of Chicago, doing an early warning system for the City of Chicago Police Department, and they've expanded since then and now are developing statewide systems. So it was really a perfect fit for what we needed. They just went live at the beginning of the year with Colorado for a training database, and they're doing the use of force reporting for the state of New Jersey. So as one with experience working with new software systems or newer companies, it is encouraging that they've already built something out there, and hopefully someone else is the guinea pig and we get the good stuff when all the bugs are worked out. But we're well into it, and I will keep you updated on that count. We're working on hiring staff positions. We're finally getting there. We got some posted. We have a number of positions to fill, the assistant executive director, two continuing ed positions. Those are the folks that deal with continuing education, and a standards coordinator. And that person, that position came out of the reform legislation to primarily work on the database. And what do we do with that complaint data when it comes in? How do we track it, and so on and so forth? The part I referred to regarding the rules is the job task analysis of the police officer position. That is best practices say to do that every 5 years. So we are on year five. 2020 was the fifth year since it was last done, and it was last done in-house. What I'm trying to do right now is I've reached out to several academic institutions and also some of our other partners in municipal community to find someone who does this for a living. This is their job. They do a job task analysis. And what that is basically we're going to look at the entire position. What does it require to be a police officer in the state of Minnesota or generally as a police officer? And then that will then inform the data, the basis of data for us to make decisions about what should pre-service look like. What is what we're teaching in pre-service still what we should be teaching? Does it still apply? Does it apply to the job of police officer today in 2021, or is it a vestige of something from 1970? So in order to do that, you need a good job task analysis to assess what we should be doing going forward. Then finally, I'll just close out by saying there'll be a lot of additional involved discussions, and there's a lot of complexity here. We're doing our best to work our way through it because there's a lot of meshing. It's a system, and I say that to anybody who will listen. Rules are connected to statute, are connected to complaints, are connected to, it's all together. And if we're going to make changes in, for instance, the pre-service, that should reflect also what we're doing in continuing education and then mesh with either rules or statutes. I know Chair Mariani and others in the legislature, also in the Senate, have asked, what would you like? Or you have any ideas for legislation for us? And the short answer is I can't give them a good answer. I'm not ready to come to the chair with major suggestions yet because we're still figuring this out. We will need it. There are definitely changes that will need to be done to legislation or rules. It's best to have a good idea and have the data gathered as the chair hits home every time. Good data makes good decisions. So we're working on that. And that's it. With that, that's my summary, if you will, Chair. And I stand ready for any additional questions.
Terrific. Thank you, Director Missold and Chief and Chair McCarthy. I have to say I'm encouraged by the approach and the tone of the post under both of your respective leadership. I actually like that picture you painted, Director Missel, with the convergence of rules, statute, and you called complaints. I like to think of it because that is sort of the mechanics of it, dealing with a, concern, a complaint. I like to think of it as the expectations of both professionals in this field and citizens. And so, you know, the coming together of that is all about very good government. And so I really appreciate that. We're going to do a deeper dive in subsequent hearing on some of the reform, or much of the reform efforts underway. I will just very quickly flag that there are some data collection issues that I want to be able to bring forward in regards to that early warning system that I want the committee to have you know, strong conversations around to make sure that we have the best data under which that we can make good decisions. But I won't use up other members' times for questions and just jump into a few members. Representative O'Neill, I'll start with you. We'll then go to Representative Frazier, Representative Huat, and Representative Novotny. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had to jump off quick to talk to somebody, a constituent. But I was wondering, since we still have the BCA here, if I could just ask a quick question about the DNA lab and the database for victims of sexual assault for their rape kits. Did he give an update at all about that? And wondering if he could, if he didn't already, quickly do an update on that. I know lots of people in the public are asking me about that. So.
Representative O'Neill, if we have time after this, I will certainly, if they're still here, I'll pull you back up to have that question. If we can't get it in this time, they will be back. We will go into deeper dives, but I do appreciate the question. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. So in recent days, our country has gone through a lot. We've seen what's happened at the Capitol in D.C. We've seen the threats that are potential threats to our own Capitol here and our elected officials here. There was just an article today that says that dozens of folks that attended the Capitol riots and conducted some of the violence there were listed as terrorists on the FBI's list. And it went on to note that the majority of those folks were considered to be affiliated with white supremacist groups. So I put that context because one of my questions that I have, and Chief McCarthy, it may be something that you can address. Have we ever had, let me add this piece too. I will say that I've been working for a few years now, meeting on a consistent basis with some police chiefs and officers in the Northwest suburbs. And these are folks that are absolutely committed to public service, committed to the work that they do, passionate about serving the public and protecting the public, but they absolutely want to see anything that is going to be harmful to the profession and therefore harmful to the narrative about the work that they do rooted out of their departments in their profession. So I'll say that because I know those folks exist. I work closely with them, and I want to advocate and push for the things that they want to see get done. It's going to make things better for our community. So my question is, in light of the information that we're getting from the investigations that are happening after the Capitol riots and the violence and the deaths that occurred there because of that, and also in light of this, there was an intelligence report from 2006 that was declassified and unredacted that also talked about the concern that our intelligence communities have nationally in regards to white supremacist groups infiltrating our law enforcement departments. And the fact that we could have law enforcement officers that are sympathetic to their causes, lending their services and their access to these groups. Have we ever had any such complaints investigated at the Post Board, to your knowledge? To your knowledge, have we ever had that? I'd like to know. And the reason is because I'm looking to possibly bring legislation to address these concerns.
Chief McCarthy.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Frazier, to my knowledge, we have not received complaints, nor have we revoked the license of any peace officer in Minnesota for being a member of a group that is deemed a white supremacist group. Any problem that exists in society exists within the police officer ranks because we are members of society. So if domestic abuse is a problem in society, it's a problem within the police ranks. White supremacy is a problem in our community. White supremacy is a problem within our police ranks. The issue with the Post Board is our ability to, as you said, you were thinking about legislation, because we primarily deal with convictions. And because being a member of a hate group or a white supremacist group is not a violation of the law, that wouldn't really come to us. And usually agency by agency will have policies regarding what types of groups their members could be part of.
Very well. Representative Frazier?
Yes, Chief McCarthy, thank you for sharing that. And that's exactly what I...
Representative Frazier, if I could just for a second, there's some background noise. If you all can mute when you're not speaking, that would greatly help. With cutting down on interrupting the discussion here. Representative Frazier.
Chief McCarthy, thank you for sharing that. And that's exactly what I want to address. You may know my background is I'm a labor attorney, and mainly I work in the education arena. And the licensee boards that I operate or navigate in those instances, they have the ability based on the code of conduct to deal with things like that. And I want to make sure that we have that the Post Board has the ability to address those issues if need be. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that information.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Huon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, testifiers. To the chief or to the director, just real curious. I have many, many friends that are in law enforcement, in an EMS. I did that through the years, and I know the big day of Post Board to move on to that next step is so important. And like EMS, this was also developed in the 70s, and I always like to take a fresh look at things. Is Minnesota one of the only states that uses the Post Board model, or just briefly, or if you need to do it offline, could I get more information on what other states do to bring in their credentialing, or is it done by individual departments? I know we have a high requirement, but I just kind of want to know what other people are doing.
Good question. Thank you. Chief McCarthy or Director Missel?
Director. I can take that one. Thank you. The short answer is yes, other states do something similar. There are multiple post boards. There's quite a wide variety, as you would imagine, across 50 states and how they handle it. I mentioned that Minnesota's a licensing state. Not all states are licensing states. In fact, the state I did most of my career in, it was a certification state, so they had a little bit less leeway, actually, in dealing with conduct than Minnesota does. So you'll see a wide variety. One thing I would suggest is that the audit that we had done does mention, does lay out some of the states we were compared to and talks about some of the comparisons in terms of how they do business. But I can certainly, I have your email. I could send you some additional information, some links to what they do. And I'd be more than happy anytime you wanted to just have a conversation if you'd like me to, kind of flesh it out a little bit. But there is some sort of regulatory agency in almost every state with regard to law enforcement. Some are stronger than others. Some go farther than others.
Yeah, Director Missel, and I look forward to a conversation about that audit and to further put ourselves in context with other states in terms of both their governance but also their practices and rules. So thank you for that question, Representative Huon. I did have Representative Navani on the list, but maybe I was mistaken, but I want to make sure since I named it whether I should be calling on you, Representative Navani.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Actually, I did have a separate question, and I was going to take that offline. Okay. But for Director Mislett, with the extensive background checks that are done and the psychological examinations, would it be fair to say that any member of any hate group would possibly be identified for selection or elimination from the selection process as a peace officer? Aren't there steps already in place to weed out any person that has hate in their minds?
And just to be clear, Representative Avdi, this was an inquiry from Representative Frazier, who's contemplating legislation, but Director Missel, anything in terms of current practice relative to that question? Director Missel?
I'll step in for him here, Chair, if that would be okay.
Sure, Chair McCarthy.
Yes, Representative Novotny, we do extensive background checks to officers prior to them coming into the skills program, as well as prior to them coming into the police profession and each individual agency. I would, as much as smart as we like to think we are, I don't know that I could ever tell you who has hate in their mind. I can tell you if they associate with groups that are listed as hate groups, or if they have tattoos that would be representative of membership in a group that our agency would not want to be associated with. So any extremist groups that part of membership is in contradiction with our state constitution and then our department values could be weeded out at that time. Once that's going forward, we don't really have those mechanisms in place right now.
Very well, thank you. Thank you, Representative Botney, for your question. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard in the past some concerns about content evaluation for trainings, and I was curious what changes have been made recently in how we evaluate what types of trainings are certified.
Director Missel?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Long. And I apologize for that earlier. All of a sudden, my connection was terrible and I couldn't hear a word. With regard to the training, right now it's, I hesitate to say status quo because we have made changes in terms of how much detail we go into. And of course, we are now considering with the legislation that warrior training is an example, we're evaluating it for that. As of this moment, we're reconfiguring how we look at training and trying to determine how we narrow down and assess training rather than approving any and all training that's law enforcement related that comes through, narrowing it down to the most important kind of training, mandated training, and so on. One of the things that we're looking for out of the software program that is both going to be database for complaints and other, notification of investigations is the training piece. And included in there is an evaluation functionality. That's something we don't get now. So where courses will be evaluated. We can make them mandatory to be evaluated and submitted, and then get our head around what that data is telling us as those evaluations and those reviews come in. I would just say globally that because of a lot of things we've talked about in the past, my focus, and I think the board's focus is going to be, we want to concentrate in on those high risk, high liability, important training pieces, the mandated training. And I think I mentioned this before, maybe even to this committee, or at least for me, I'd like to see us push aside the stuff that really, I mean, it's nice. And if Chief McCarthy is an example, just wants to send an officer to an Excel training course, great. I don't know that requires a post-board oversight to review that course, whereas a use of force or firearms training, we would want to. So I would just say we're aware of it and we're reconfiguring as we speak, like a lot of things. So I hope that helps.
All right. Thank you, Director Missel. And Chief McCarthy, Director Missel, again, thank you for being with us here today and for being very concise and very thorough in your sharing vital information with us. Look forward to the ongoing conversation. We'll be visiting again soon in the committee here. Representative O'Neill, I am going to squeeze your question in because why not? And I do see that Director Evans is still with us. Hopefully he can hear us. Yes, and so maybe Representative Leo, if you can just recast your question. We're only going to have a couple minutes to be able to question and answer here. Representative Leo.
Thank you. I was just looking for an update of the legislation that we passed in October for the test all rape kit, where the scientists hired, is the lab ready to go? Are they doing storage, that kind of thing, just regarding that bill that passed for victims?
Yeah, so similar to Representative Pintle's earlier question, I believe, Director Evans.
Yeah, so, and I'd be happy to go over any specifics if there's questions. As we talked about a little earlier, we are receiving the restricted kits now, and so we're storing them actively. To recap on that, so we've got a process in place for that. We're in the process of the RFP for the tracking software, but I think more specifically to your question about the scientists, we had a number of temporary scientists under a number of different grant programs. We're always working through grants that we were able to transition into our DNA test all team that will be focusing on sexual assault examination kits. That is a unit that's going now. We're identifying a supervisor to oversee that specialized unit for a sexual assault examination kits. And then we're working actively on hiring some additional scientists right now. So it's all moving. We have people in those positions, and then we're hiring the rest of them as we can. So we're online with that. We'll be reaching full capacity as soon as we get the remaining. I don't know the exact number of hiring, but I know they're all in the hiring process, and a number have already been transitioned to that.
Super. Thank you. We're out of time. I do want to very quickly shout out Representative Grassl. You and I exchanged some text after the earlier conversation. I appreciate your receptiveness to my desire to keep us moving here. I look forward to working with you this year. Members, we will meet again tomorrow at 10:30, and on the docket will be a conversation with the Department of Corrections, as well as a conversation on our state's somewhat unique probation delivery systems. So until that time, this committee stands adjourned.